Hi, this is Henry Gross. You remember me from my big hit Shannon. And I'm here with Robert Miller on his wonderful Follow Your Dream podcast.
Everyone has a dream. Robert Miller is a musician who had a dream to become a rock star. He followed his dream and he succeeded. If you're ready to pursue and succeed at your dream, then listen up and get inspired and motivated to take action today. Welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the award-winning Follow Your Dream podcast with listeners all around the world in 200 countries. I'm Robert Miller, your host. My guest today is Roger Cook, hit singer, songwriter, and producer. He wrote hits like You've Got Your Troubles, and Here Comes That Rainy Day Feeling Again for The Fortunes, Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress for The Hollies, and I Believe in You for Don Williams. He also wrote hits for Gary Lewis, Engelbert Humperdinck, Deep Purple, and Andy Williams. And also among his hits was I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, which originally was created as a commercial for Coke, but was re-recorded and crossed over as a pop hit. And in the middle of this episode, as I do with all my musician guests, Roger and I are going to do a song fest. We're going to play a bit of those songs that I just mentioned, and we're going to talk about them. You get the backstories, and nobody else does this in podcasts. And you also know that I like to feature a song of mine in every episode underneath the introduction and at the end. And I always try to make it relevant somehow to my guest. And in this instance, the song that I'm featuring is something called A Thousand Days. I originally wrote it as a global warming protest song, but I always thought it could make a cool commercial or public service announcement. See what you think. So, Roger Cook, welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast, baby.
Good to be here, Robert.
A pleasure to have you here. You know, as I was reading the introduction, I'm saying to myself, the words Deep Purple and Andy Williams were together in a sentence. That's not something you hear too often, do you?
No. Yeah, well, we were pretty wide range in our writing. I like to think I could write anything, jazz, country, pop, rock, whatever.
Well, you did write at least one country hit because we're going to play that one later. But tell me, what did you write for Deep Purple? What did you write for Andy Williams?
Andy Williams, the song was Home Loving Man. And it was a big hit for him in England. We're going back now to the mid-70s.
Right.
Deep Purple, I'm just trying to think. I think it was I Am the Preacher.
I am the preacher with a message for my people.
That was the name of the song that they cut. Did really well, so anyway.
Well, you must be correct that you were able to write in every different type of style and genre, because the names that have come back here are just wild when you think about the different types of music that they recorded. You know, Andy Williams was a big, big star in the United States. He had this television show. He wore a sweater every time when he came on the air. It was a very PC and PG rated kind of show.
The Andy Williams Show.
Yeah, we got that show in England.
Oh, you did, huh?
Oh, yeah. So I was very aware of it. And, of course, thrilled to get the song with him.
This is American culture. It travels around the world, and you get the Andy Williams Show. Good for you. All right, you know, I wanted to start off talking about your experience writing that song, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. Because, you know, there was a time when a handful of songs started out as commercials And then they morphed into real hits. And that was one of them. So tell me about your experience writing that song.
Well, we did quite a bunch of Coke commercials in the late 60s, early 70s. And this was just another commercial. A guy called Bill Backer, who was worked with McCann Erickson, did the Coca-Cola commercials. He came up with this idea of it's the real thing. And he wanted us to try and come up with a tune and an idea that would marry with that idea. And I think it's Roger Greenaway said, well, we've got this tune, which we did, which had an awful lyric, and it was a dog of a song, but the tune was pretty. And so we played them the tune, and they said, yeah. And then we worked on the lyric. And Roger Greenaway came up with the idea of, I'd like to teach the world to sing. And I think I threw in Imperfect Harmony. And the guys who were running the commercial with said, yes, that'll work. And we did the it went out as a radio jingle and it didn't do too much business at all. But then in 1971, Coca-Cola had the idea. They would like a song that kind of was a message for the world. You know, brothers and sisters all in it together.
Right.
And that commercial was aired to Coke, and they went, yes, that's the one.
Now, was it the same song as the original jingle, or did you change it for the Coke commercial?
They added some different words to it. For the Coke commercial, it had its own thing. Obviously, Coca-Cola was in there.
I like to teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
There was such a huge response to the TV ad, which was like a video, one of the early videos, if you like, music video. There was such a huge response. Coca-Cola got inundated with thousands of letters a day saying, where can we buy the song? Well, this didn't go unnoticed by a man called Billy Davis, who was very involved with the project. And he went into the studio and cut two different versions. And both of them fought their way up the charts at the same time. And, well, one of them won out, which was the New Seekers. They won out in the end.
I'd like to teach the world to sing.
I'm glad to say it was very good.
It was a terrific song. And this was an era where, again, this happened a couple of times. I can only think of a couple of instances. There was that Alka-Seltzer commercial, if you remember. Whatever shape your stomach is in.
No matter what shape your stomach's in.
And that got picked up. And that got turned into a pop hit as well. It was just that era that did it. And it was such a good song. Like you said, everybody was singing that. It was all over the television when you wrote that Coke commercial.
You remember that big TV show recently, Mad Men?
Right.
And right at the very end of the final performance of Mad Men, the guy's on the hill listening to I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, which I thought was pretty damn neat.
Wow. Did you know they were going to do that?
No, I had no idea. And it was such a big show. Everybody kept saying, heard your song, which was neat.
What a nice surprise, huh? To have something like that come back after 50 or so years, and it's in the finale of that great big show.
Just wacky.
Yeah, totally. All right, listen, let's go back to your songwriting career. Did you get raised in a musical family? How did you become a musician?
Yes, my father was a musician. He played piano, fiddle, and banjo. And we had those evenings, those mystical evenings where we sat down, Dad played, and we all sang harmonies. I have four siblings, you know, and we all sang. And I was involved with church choirs. I sang church choirs, and it gave me a great grounding for harmonies. But the reason I wrote my very first song is because I was in a group, a doo-wop group, And one of the guys who'd written a song that the girl singer was singing in the group, and I got very jealous. And I thought, if you can write a bloody song, so can I. So I sat down and wrote a song, and it was pretty easy. And I thought, oh, okay then. So from then on, I started writing songs on a regular basis.
Now, were you a songwriter exclusively at that time, or did you play an instrument as well? Tell us how that worked.
No, I was in a doo-wop group, so I never had to learn to play anything.
Uh-huh.
But in 1963, I did a show in Coventry in England, and one of the guys in there who was also singing said, do you want to buy a ukulele? I said, what would I do with a ukulele? I can't play one. He said, I'll teach you three chords. He taught me the three chords, and I said, how much do you want for it? £6, which in today's money is probably like 50 bucks or something. And I said, yeah, okay then. So I bought it, and I taught myself to play it, and of course I've written thousands of songs on a ukulele ever since.
Isn't that great? I had a lady on the show early on. Lisa Ray was her name, from the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. I think that was the name of the outfit. And they do these wild cover versions of all kinds of rock hits, all on the ukulele.
I'm aware of them. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. And George Harrison was also a big ukulele guy, I found out, you know, at one point.
Yeah, he loved ukulele. In fact, I have a huge buddy called Joe Brown, who was a star back in the late 50s, early 60s. And he and George were very big friends. And they would have evenings where they just got the ukes out and played a bunch of old ukulele-inspired hits, you know.
Yeah. In fact, I understand that Paul McCartney frequently in concert will take out the ukulele and sing something in honor of George on the ukulele.
Something in the way she moved strikes me like no other lover. Something in the way she wounds me. I don't want to leave her now. You know.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, it really is.
That's great.
All right, so you're singing doo-wop. You know, what always amazed me about doo-wop is that 99% of the songs had the same four chords, okay?
That's right.
And every song sounded a little different.
Yeah, then I call it the Blue Moon chords.
That's it.
Because it's like C, A minor, F, G, you know.
F, exactly.
And you're right. Thousands of songs were written on those four chords, and especially the doo-wop days, Earth Angel. You know, and stuff like that. So I wrote my fair share of four chord songs.
That's what it was. Did you go on to do skiffle at all? Because that was big in England, right, at one time?
Yeah, I was never in a skiffle group. But funny enough, myself and my buddy I named just now, Joe Brown, we've written a show called Skiffle. We're hoping to get it on.
Uh-huh.
Because it was a magic period in English musical history. In about 1957, suddenly the kids had something they could play that belonged to them, not their mum and dad's music. And there were tens of thousands of little skiffle groups all over England in the late 50s. And of course, when skiffle died, they went out and got a drummer and got an amplifier. And suddenly there was 10,000 little rock bands all over England. And so when the boom came with the Beatles, there were so many groups ready to go.
Did you know the Beatles before they became the Beatles internationally?
No. No, I can't say I did. I got to know Paul and I got to know John a little, and Ringo I took in the studio once. But no, we never did. But the group I joined, my second doo-wop group, used to open up for the Beatles. And they taught the Beatles how to bow. The Beatles were very knocked out by the way that these kestrels would go down together and sync them up and sing. And so that's one claim to fame.
Well, listen, they were so influenced, as were all the other English groups, by American music in general.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody went through that skiffle craze that you're talking about, which really never made it to the United States. Although we used to have the washboard basses and things like that, but that was more of a sideline kind of thing. And then, of course, the world changed in the early 60s there.
Oh, yeah. And how? There was one big skiffle hit in America by a man called Lonnie Donegan. And it was the
Rock Island?
Rock Island Line.
Oh, well, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride it. The Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like a fine. You get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
And does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight? If your mother says don't chew it, do you swallow it in spite? Can you catch it on your tonsils? Can you heave it left and right?
That was another one.
That was his too?
Yes, that was his too.
Yeah, that was a big one. I agree with you on that. Hi, everybody. This is Robert Miller, your host. You know, one of the many benefits to me of doing this podcast is being able to collaborate musically with some of my guests who are among the best musicians in the world. My first collaboration was with the great Jim Peterik of the Ides of March and formerly with Survivor. Jim and I collaborated on The Fall of Winter, a song about a blue-collar worker who dreams of a better life. Also contributing was Elliot Randall, the renowned guitarist. John Helliwell was the amazing saxophonist in Supertramp, one of the greatest bands of the rock era. John collaborated with me on my 2023 album, Bobby M. and the Paisley Parade, and he's featured on several tracks. One of them is This Time. Tony Carey is a singer-songwriter and keyboard genius who played with Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow. Tony has collaborated with me on several recordings, including his exquisite organ playing on All of the Time.
I want you all of the time. I need you all of the time.
And I'm finishing up a new collaboration right now with trumpeter Randy Brecker, formerly with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Collaborations like these make the podcast very special indeed. As always, thank you for listening and keep on rocking. All right, so let's go into the Songfest thing because you had such great songs. And I loved the Fortunes. Okay, the mid-60s was my era when I was coming of age musically. And the whole British invasion thing, as we called it in America, it took over the country, took over the world, of course. But the Fortunes and the song You've Got Your Troubles, that became a gigantic hit.
She's found somebody else to take your place. You've got your troubles, I've got mine. I too have lost my love today. All of my dreams have flown away.
Tell us the backstory on that one.
Well, again, I was in that second doo-wop group called the Kestrels. And Roger Greenaway was one of them. He invited me to join the band because somebody left. I called it the band. It was a group. Anyway, Roger and I, we were on tour, opening up for Herman's Hermits. And who else? The Mindbenders.
Dean Fontana and the Mindbenders.
Yes. And it was a big tour. We were opening for them. And one night, one afternoon, I should say, it was between shows. Roger said, you write songs? I said, yeah. He said, you want to write one? I said, yeah, sure. He sat down and he played da 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 da. I said, oh, I like that. I started on the lyrics straight away. And within about an hour and a half, we had the total song finished. We took it back up to London when we had a break from the show and demoed it. And George Martin heard it, and George said, "I really like the way you sing." He said, "I love the song. I'd like to produce you." "Okay, George, you bet your life." Anyway, but George was held up for about 3 months with an album called Rubber Soul. He was in the studio with the boys. And we had to wait 3 months. And in that 3 months' time, a group called The Fortunes got hold of the song and got it out very quickly. And of course, they had the big hit.
Now, how did they get hold of it? Did you pitch it to them, or did George pitch it to them, or what?
It had gotten pitched around before George came to us. Maybe George heard it a little later, you know, but it was mixed feelings. Here we are, suddenly our lives were changing. We had a hit record going all the way around the world, but we could have been the artist.
It could have been your fortune.
Yeah. Anyway, George felt sorry for us, and he said, "There's a song on Rubber Soul," he said, "I'll produce with you if you can work a routine out on it." And it was a Michelle. So Roger and I had the big hit. That's David and Jonathan with Michelle.
Michelle, my belle, these are words that go together well. My Michelle, Michelle, my belle, sont les mots qui vont très bien ensemble, très bien ensemble.
That's not too bad as a backup price, huh?
Yeah.
All right, I want to ask you something. You were talking about when you and Roger wrote You've Got Your Troubles. And it always amazed me that in that era, guys like yourself and, of course, Lennon and McCartney, you would write something and you would remember it. Okay, so that when you actually came time to record it, you remembered the lyrics, you remembered the way the whole song went. Now, if I don't sing something into my iPhone immediately, I forget it in 2 hours. How did you do it?
I can only say it was early days and our brains were wide open and receptive. And so a good melody never got forgotten, ever, or a lyrical idea, you know. So that's changed somewhat now. I do have to sing into a little tape recorder now. Especially if an idea comes to me late at night, I want to remember it in the morning. I must put it down. But in the early days, no, I didn't have to. We never forgot tunes or lyrical ideas or anything.
You know, the other thing that I remember reading about Lennon and McCartney, Paul mentioned that when he and John went into a room to write, they would spend 2 or 3 hours and they never failed to come out with an entire song, a completed song. When you wrote with Roger, did you find that you were able to get complete songs as you were writing together?
Yes, very quickly. Yes, we did. A hit song usually doesn't take more than a couple of hours. It's the really good songs that take a long time, and you wait a long time to get them cut too. But hit songs, no, they come very quickly, which I think is why the public pick up on the melodies and the lyrical ideas so quickly, because it's just a natural process, you know.
Well, it doesn't come that quickly for everybody, but good for you that it worked out. Tell us about the follow-up hit that you had with The Fortunes, Here Comes That Rainy Day.
Here comes that rainy day feeling again. And I'll be dreaming of you, baby, in vain. Your face is always on my mind, girl. I'm hoping soon you're gonna find, girl, your way back to me. 'Cause if you say you stay, the rainy days will go away.
Well, that was like nearly 6 years later.
Right.
I was in a car once. I'd been having lunch with a friend of mine, Tony McCauley, who was a great writer himself and wrote so many hits. And he said, "I got a great idea for a song." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Here Comes That Rainy Day Feeling Again." I said, "Oh, I like that. Can I have it for, you know, for a couple of weeks?" He said, "Sure." So I went home and wrote the bloody song. And when I played it, he said, well, thank you very much for writing our song. Anyway, he and I worked on the bridge a little bit, that's all. But the idea came very quickly. And I've got to thank Tony McCauley for the title.
Was he ticked off that you used the title?
No. He was very happy when it went up the charts in America.
You know, that's like the story about how George Harrison, to quote him again, picked up that first line from the James Taylor song, Something in the Way She Moves.
Yeah.
Everybody takes from everybody else, but it's all in good spirits, I think.
That was a great song, Something. I recorded it as an artist myself.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover.
And one of the miraculous things on it is Paul McCartney's bass.
Yes.
It's one of the best bass lines I ever heard on any record ever.
It's interesting you say that because I'm a bass player myself. And in a sense, I always felt exactly as you said, it's a wonderful bass part. And it broke every rule because in a sense, it was a lead bass part that he played.
Yes.
He was playing fills throughout the entire song, but it's so beautiful. It worked out so well.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Totally. All right. Let's move on to that gigantic hit you had with the Hollies, Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress. Tell us about that one.
Well, Alan had talked to our plugger. He'd seen him somewhere on a radio show or something. He said, do you think Cookie would write a song with me? And my mate said, yeah. He said, I'll put you two together. So Alan came over one day. We were going to write 10 o'clock start in the morning. And we stood looking at each other and just farting around and nothing happened for about 2 hours. He said, are you hungry? I said, yeah. He said, let's go and eat. So we went down to an Italian restaurant, downed a bottle of wine between us and a couple of large cognacs, and flew back up to the office and sat down. In the space of 2 hours, we wrote that song on the piano, as it so happened. And I had this weird way of playing, which just moved my thumb up and down, which is where the riff came from, you know. And Alan was the one, not the lead guitarist, but it was Alan who worked out the down, which was a great little riff.
Now, this is Alan Clark you're talking about?
Yes. He's the guitarist on it.
Yes, I've had Alan on this podcast, and he talked a little bit about that song as well. And he took a lot of pleasure in that little riff that you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah, it's a great riff. I mean, that's half the song. You know, when it comes on, you immediately know the song. You know, it's one of those intros. Great.
So the moral of this story is that you got to get drunk to write a hit song. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it doesn't necessarily hurt.
Oh, well. Did you do any other work for the Hollies?
We had a hit in England and in Europe with a song called Gasoline Alley Bread. Which again, I wrote with Tony McCauley. So that was a hit with the Hollies. It wasn't a huge hit, but it was like a top 10.
So tell me, when you were writing, were you writing for specific artists or did you just write and it just went wherever it was supposed to go?
Yeah, we never wrote really for artists, or very, very seldom. Not one in 100 did we write for an artist, particularly. I like to just sit down and write a song, simply, and then after I played it through to myself once, see if it sounds like anyone. And then you can obviously try and get the song to them, you know, whether it's a George Strait or Don Williams or Crystal Gayle or whoever, you know.
I mean, there came a point in time in the music industry where the artists were not looking to songwriters. They were writing them themselves. You know, it's that whole singer-songwriter era of the 1970s. Did that change things for you guys?
Yeah, it did. And it wasn't a bad thing, but it changed our income. Like, you got your troubles, I got mine. We had over 50 recordings of that in the first year or so that came out. I mean, weird people cut it. Sammy Davis Jr., you know, Nancy Wilson. I mean, people cut it. Neil Diamond cut it. The Four Seasons cut it. It was, in those days, a songwriter, if you had a big hit song, it was going to get covered by a lot of people on albums. That's kind of gone. That's all over. Doesn't happen anymore. So we missed out on that. We have done the last, like, 20 years, 30 years or so. But that's okay.
I got to look for that Sammy Davis Jr. version. Okay.
And I see that worried look on your face. You got your trouble, well, I got mine.
The session was set up for Frank Sinatra, and he couldn't sing it. It was out of his range. And so Sammy Davis did it.
That's amazing. Did Sinatra ever record any of your songs?
No. I wish he had. Now, Bing Crosby did. I had a couple of records with Bing Crosby, which my dad said, you can't get any bigger than that, son. My dad was very impressed.
I can imagine. That's fantastic. All right, so let's switch gears here. You had this big country hit with Don Williams called I Believe in You. I mean, this one was just so different from the others that we've talked about.
I don't believe the price of gold, the certainty of growing old, that right is right and left is wrong, that north and south can't get along, that east is east and west is west, and being first is always best, but I believe in love. I believe in I believe in mom and dad, and I believe in you.
Tell us about this one.
Well, I just wrote the song one day, and I played it to a friend of mine, Sammy Hogan. And he said, it's a great song to make. And he said, but nobody's going to cut it with those lyrics. And he pinpointed the lyrics that country singers wouldn't sing, you know. So I said, well, help me out then. So he sat down with me and we changed quite a few lines. And Don Williams' producer, who was a good friend, Garth Funders, came in asking if I had any songs for Don. We played in that song, and halfway through the demo being played, Garth Funders said, look at that, and the hairs on his arm were standing up. He said, Don would have a big hit with that. He said, but you might have to change some lyrics. He wouldn't sing the rising cost of getting high. He sang the rising cost of getting by. And he wouldn't sing I Don't Give a Damn, which was in my original lyric. He sang Sometimes I Wonder Who I Am. And it was Don Williams, so I let him get away with it.
There you go. Well, listen, the lyrics were actually really terrific in that song, okay?
Oh, thank you.
Very topical, and they worked together so well. But, I mean, it was such a different type of song. Did you ever do other songs like that, country, western type things?
Yeah, I had a few other hits, country hits from George Strait. And Don Williams cut a song of I wrote with John Prine. And took to number one for a couple of weeks, called Love Is On a Roll.
I can't work late, although I need the money. Gotta get home to my loving honey.
She'll be there waiting, waiting impatiently. Love is on a roll, love is on a good roll.
Which was really neat.
Terrific. Are you still writing?
Yeah, I write at least a couple of songs a week. It's getting tougher because I'm not quite in the flow of things that are happening at the moment with country music. I don't particularly like what's happening, and so it's very hard to write something you don't like.
I would say it's very hard to predict what works in this music market in general. I mean, you got some things that are getting a billion plus streams, and to me, some of it is not even music. It's just a lot of beats, okay? And then you got other things that, you know, fly to the top of the charts, but it's so hard because there are no gatekeepers anymore, right? Everything is just put it out on the internet and see what happens.
Yeah, put it out on YouTube and just cross your fingers, you know. I have nothing against all those young guys who are writing those hits now. I mean, good luck to them. It's a tough business, so I'm very happy for them. I wish I could have a nice big number one tomorrow, but all I can do is write the kind of songs I like.
There you go. Well, it's worked for you for decades, and just keep doing what you're doing. How about that?
Thank you, Robert. I think I'll do that.
All right. We have been speaking here with the incredible Roger Cook, who has written so many wonderful hits over the years. I like the fact that you're still smiling, Roger. That's the way to keep going.
Oh, yes.
And I want to thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Thank you, Robert. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And we're going to listen now to that song that started off the episode. It's my song called A Thousand Days. I want to thank you all for listening. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss another inspiring episode. You can connect with Robert at robert@followyourdreampodcast.com. And you can hear more from his band at projectgrandslam.com.
Why can't you hear? Don't you see we're in? Told me once that you didn't have fear, but things have changed now. The trouble is near. The day is night, and the night has a haze. I've seen this coming for a thousand days. Think of the children. Think how this will go. For it.